I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of acting and resting in attention.
No. I think at the end, last time we went to the first four, which were right view, right intention, right action, and right livelihood. No, right speech and right action. That's right. And I want to pick up on right action because there are a few more points that I wanted to cover there. Now, the general thesis that I want to present to you and want you to consider here is that in all of these areas, we don't practice, say, I like to use the example of right speech, as it's very easy to see there. We don't practice right speech by trying to say what is truthful in a gentle way that is non-divisive and timely or relevant. Because when you try to speak that way, it always comes out somewhat contrived. You're trying to make your speech fit a certain formula, and it just isn't quite natural. Even if you get quite good at it, it's like the forced smiles that models wear. You know, when you smile naturally, it's different from when you smile, you have the intention to smile, because there are certain muscles which aren't activated when you try to smile intentionally, and it doesn't look right. The way that you practice right speech is you bring attention into the act of speaking. And the method that I suggest here is that you listen to the sound of your own voice when you speak as if you're listening to another person. And when we do this, we immediately hear when something is amiss or inappropriate or doesn't fit the situation. We find we're speaking too loudly or too softly, or our mother has suddenly crept into our voice, or maybe our father, or there's some kind of edge which we didn't really intend to be there. And I remember many years ago when I was reading Wittgenstein, he was talking about a speech and how words have meaning and so forth. And he said, you know, we actually never know what we're going to say until it comes out our mouth. Until it actually happens. So this principle of bringing attention into what we are doing is the core of the practice of the Eightfold Path. Now, when it comes to action, it's basically an extension of speech. Speech is a relatively simple form of action. And I've consistently found that people can be very, very good at their practice. They can sit very well. Their minds can rest. They can listen very well. They even can walk with good attention. And as soon as they open their mouth, it all goes out the window. And the reason is because there isn't much emphasis on actually practicing speaking in attention. And it's something that I hope you will try. Even more so, people aren't used to acting in attention. That as soon as they start to act, old familiar patterns take over and they're just gone. I had the very vivid experience of this when I was teaching a Mahamudra class, and this is very, very, very long time ago. I was working with a group of about 12 students, and we met monthly. And I wanted them just to explore the experience of listening. So I deliberately chose the Jabberwocky, which is full of just all of these nonsense words, and you kind of tell something's going on, but you're not really sure what it is. But it was a disastrous mistake, for at least for my purposes, because most of the people in the group were familiar with the Jabberwocky, and as soon as I started to read it, they moved right back to being a child, and their parents were reading them the Jabberwocky, and they just went, oh, this feels so good. And their practice was gone. There was no attention. They just moved right back into that experience. And this is what happens most of the time when we start to act. Now, there are some disciplines where you learn how to move your body in attention. Dance is one. Martial arts is another, because if you aren't paying attention when you move your body, you're liable to get hit, if not killed. But except for a few things like that, we aren't used to moving, bringing our attention into the actual movement of our bodies, which is one component of practice. We aren't used to bringing attention into how we interact with people. At a retreat I did, Mount Baldy, again many years ago, I divided people up into groups of three. And one person was to rake up leaves or pine needles mindfully. The second person was to watch them, and whenever they saw them not doing it mindfully, they were to correct them and make a suggestion. And the third person was to watch the interaction, and if saw that there was something unmindful going on in the interaction, then they were to coach that. Well, it was very interesting. The behavior in each of these groups was identical. And we rotated around, so everybody experienced every position. But everybody reported exactly the same experience. It was my first lesson in sociology. The person who was doing the actual work regarded the other two as interfering. And they were quite content just to do their work and rake mindfully and not be bothered. This person whose job it was to monitor the person who was raking felt that because they were monitoring, they had to say something. And if they didn't say anything, they weren't really doing their job. So they started managing this person even when there was nothing to manage. The third person felt the same kind of thing and kept stepping in and taking over the second person's job so that those two would get into a fight all the time. And this happened in group after group after group. There was zero attention, well, except for the person who was actually doing the work. There was zero attention. Everybody fell into their ideas of leadership and supervision and things like that, and whatever family models they had running in them, etc. And it was very educational for me. I've never found another group who's willing to do that, though. I mean, we got back into the main hall and debriefed, and boy, it took quite a while to smooth a lot of ruffled feathers. It's very interesting. But it was a very good education for me in how unused people are to exercising attention in the course of daily activities and interactions with people. And this is what right action is about.
This question was submitted by Mike in Germany. My question is about concentration, shamatha practice. Recently, I was in a discussion about the importance of developing concentration. For some Buddhist traditions, teachers, and practitioners, it is absolutely essential for developing insight. No concentration, no insight. I doubt that. Then I learned about your critical attitude towards concentration and your emphasis on returning and resting. How important is the development of jhana concentration for insight in order to release suffering? Do I need jhana concentration in order to be able to get free from suffering in my daily life?
The first, let me just make a translation point. Concentration, I think, is an inappropriate word to use for what is really being talked about, and that is stability of attention. Concentration carries the idea of a narrowing of attention, at least it does in English. And the kind of attention that we seek to cultivate in Buddhist practice, at least in my own training, which is the Mahayana tradition, is not about a narrowing of attention. And that's one of the reasons I take a critical attitude towards the word concentration. The second thing is that there are probably more than two, but I'm just going to talk about two approaches to cultivating stable attention. And one is to develop the ability to hold states of attention, which is very much what the jhana concentration practices are about, or the jhana practices. And to my mind, this is was very suitable in relatively peaceful environments, such as monastic environments and agricultural communities where Buddhism first developed. I think it is significantly more problematic in the multifaceted, very active lives that we live. What I find is that trying to hold states of attention frequently, if not inevitably, leads to certain kinds of repression or suppression of feelings, which create imbalances and which become quite serious in some cases. And that is why I put the emphasis on returning and resting. All that being said, let's turn to no concentration, no insight. And let's replace the word concentration by stability in attention. Well, one of the metaphors that is used here is that insight without stability of attention is like trying to look at the moon in a way, a reflection of the moon in a lake that is ruffled by the wind. You can see flashes of the moon, but you don't see it with any stability because the surface of the lake is disturbed by the wind. When the lake becomes still, then you see the moon very, very clearly. Now, in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions, which are my principal training, some stability of attention is necessary. I won't say absolutely necessary, it's highly desirable and very helpful, because it's easier to see how mind is when it's relatively still. Some people with talent and natural ability, see how mind is even when it's moving. And eventually we want to be able to see how mind is, whether it is still moving, and rest in mind nature, whether it is still or moving. So it now that's where we're aiming at. And it now becomes a question of method or strategy. In the beginning stages of practice, it is helpful to work at resting with the breath, and as you point out, the way I prefer to do that is resting in the experience of breathing, and when you notice that you're distracted, just returning to the experience of breathing. So you keep resting, returning, returning, and resting, returning, and resting. This way, you avoid suppressing emotions and gradually develop a level of attention so that you can rest in the arising and dissipation of emotional reactions and thoughts and things like that without the quality of attention being disturbed. The jhana approach is somewhat different. There's many capable teachers, and it gives rise to very still states of mind, which are then used to investigate and see into the nature of mind. So it really comes down to an approach that works for you. That's going to depend to some extent on who you're able to receive instruction from, the way that they train, and also what fits with you personally. And I want to emphasize that last point. The method of practice has to be something that you can pour your energy into. So the people that I work with here in Los Angeles, some people feel an affinity for some form of one form of practice and can pour their energy into that, and other people feel an affinity for another form of practice. This is why we have hundreds, thousands of different forms of practice within Buddhism. In summary, I would say don't neglect the importance of developing some stability and attention. How you do that is something you'll have to explore on your own. The jhana methods have been very helpful for a lot of people. A lot of people have found that the principle of returning and resting also very helpful. And there are many, many other techniques too.
This question is from Kareem in Los Angeles, California. Why does meditation increase attention?
Not all forms of meditation increase attention. Your question's a bit like asking, why does exercise increase fitness? Well, when we do push-ups or lift weights, we exercise muscles, and because those muscles are exercised, they grow stronger. Or when we do yoga, we exercise the muscles in a different way, and they develop other properties, such as endurance and flexibility and so forth. And it's the same with meditation. Different kinds of meditation do different things. The meditations that increase attention all have a common process. One does something which requires some attention but doesn't require any thought, and you do it over and over again. Most of the time that's breathing. And we don't have to think to breathe. And if we make the effort to experience the breath, that's what requires the attention. And then we do it over and over again. And regularly we get distracted, we fall into distraction, and we come back and keep doing it. And little by little, we develop the attention muscle in the same way that if you do push-ups, you develop stronger and stronger muscles in your arms. It increases the energy that goes going into the act of attention rather than being dissipated into reactivity.
This question is from Christina in Romania. In your Mahamudra class podcast, you said that every spiritual tradition you know of has some way of transforming emotional energy into attention by using, for instance, loving kindness, compassion, joy, or devotion. Could you please explain how these work? And secondly, are there any means other than these four?
First, how does this work? Attention is emotional energy. A lot of people probably think of it as intellectual energy, but it is much more emotional energy. And we know this because when we're receiving attention or giving attention, there's emotional engagement. It's far more than just an intellectual engagement. So by cultivating these non-reactive emotions, such as loving-kindness, compassion, and so forth, you develop a higher level of energy in your system. And that energy then becomes available for attention. So by opening to loving kindness
that quality of opening and radiant warmth to the world, then when we turn attention to something, that level of energy is there and powering the attention. The same is true for compassion or joy or devotion. The fourth immeasurable, equanimity, can also be used this way, and properly speaking should have been included in the list. That is actually very important in the Theravadan tradition, is the emotional energy of equanimity. These five, equanimity, loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and devotion, are the five that I'm familiar with. There are probably others, but I'm not thinking of them right now. It is possible to use the energy of reactive emotions, such as anger or desire or greed or pride and so forth. But it's a little trickier and a little danger. It's a little trickier to do so, because in order to transform the energy, you have to stay in the experience of the reactive emotion, not get carried away by it. If you get carried away by it, then you just are overcome by anger or desire or what have you. But there are a lot of methods, particularly in the Vajrayana, which use those reactive emotions as energy to power attention. The main problem with that is that they aren't as stable as the non-reactive emotions. Loving kindness, compassion, joy, devotion, equanimity, these can be cultivated and sustained so that they become an ongoing resource. The non-reactive emotions, by their nature, are less stable, and thus, while when they arise, you can transform them if you have enough practice and ability, but they don't provide the same basis of stability.
Retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.